Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
According to the New York Times, Ivanka Trump, like President Trump, is said to hold grudges. Well, you know what they say, the apple doesn't fall far from the orange.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. I'm Sarah Jenks Daly, a producer here at Late Night. And on today's show, Seth talks to Rebecca Mackay, the author of The Great Believers. Then, just for this podcast, I get to sit down with Rebecca backstage here at Studio 8G and ask her a few more questions about her work. But first, Seth takes a closer look at the state of the Mueller investigation.
President Trump's defenders have moved on from insisting he didn't collude with Russia to arguing that even if he did, it's not a crime. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. At some point, everyone who's close to Trump turns on him. His ex-lawyer, Michael Cohen, might be cooperating with prosecutors. Omarosa is writing a tell-all book about him. Three different people who worked for him called him stupid. Even Grimace admitted that when he shot a McDonald's commercial with Trump, he was wearing a wire. And, of course, we all remember when Grimace testified before Congress.
Do you believe Donald Trump colluded with Russia?
And Trump, who demands loyalty but never returns it, always abandons the people closest to him. For example, when Cohen's home and office were first raided by the FBI, Trump, who trusted Cohen with handling some of his most personal and sensitive matters, insisted that he had nothing to do with Cohen.
Let me just tell you that Michael is in business. He's really a businessman, a fairly big business, as I understand it. I don't know his business. Michael is a businessman. He's got a business. I would say probably the big thing is his business, and they're looking at something having to do with his business. I have nothing to do with his business. He's got businesses, and from what I understand, they're looking at his businesses, and I hope he's in great shape, yeah. But he's got businesses.
Trump says the word business like Hodor says Hodor. At his next rally, Trump's going to show up carrying Vladimir Putin on his back. Trump almost immediately threw Cohen under the bus, so it's no surprise that Cohen is now apparently turning on Trump. First, he released his secret tape of Trump discussing a hush payment to cover up an affair. Then, it was reported that federal authorities have seized more than 100 recordings made by Cohen. And Trump, unsurprisingly, is not happy about that.
The Daily Beast reporting, quote, two sources who have spoken to Trump about Cohen this week said the president was furious, hurling expletives, per one confidant, after CNN revealed Cohen had covertly recorded at least one of their conversations.
I love that they reported that Trump used expletives as if that's newsworthy. I mean, Michael Cohen seems like a guy you use expletives with even when you're on good terms. I love this guy. Give me a kiss, you brick. Well, White House staffers should get ready to hear some more expletives because last week Cohen dropped what could potentially be one of the bigger bombshells yet in the Russia investigation, claiming that Trump knew in advance about the June 2016 meeting in Trump Tower in which Russians were expected to offer his campaign dirt on Hillary Clinton, which would explain a lot. Like this mysterious promise Trump made a few days after his son, Don Jr., got the email from the Russians offering dirt on Hillary Clinton.
I am going to give a major speech on probably Monday of next week, and we're going to be discussing all of the things that have taken place with the Clintons. I think you're going to find it very informative and very, very interesting.
That's like buying a ski mask and telling the cashier, you're going to want to watch the news tonight. You got any money in First National? You might want to get it out of there. So now Trump's team is trying to paint Cohen as a liar, desperate to cut a deal. Trump's current lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, lurched out of a fog bank to go on CNN last week to make that case. Giuliani was asked first why Trump would have hired someone so willing to lie to protect himself.
He put his trust in this man for years. He entrusted him with his most sensitive matters and said, I gave him full discretion to do things I didn't need to know. It's a fundamental aspect of the president's narrative of what happened with the women. Why did he have somebody so close to him if the guy is so incredible?
That's kind of part of the human condition, right? I mean, we all make mistakes about people who turn out to be disloyal to us. You know, Benedict Arnold was disloyal to George Washington, our greatest president, right?
Did you just compare Donald Trump to George Washington? Because the only thing they have in common is wooden teeth.
God bless the United States.
Giuliani then attacked Cohen's credibility and insisted that no jury or prosecutor could ever believe Cohen over Trump.
I expected something like this from Cohen. He's been lying all week. I mean, he's been lying for years. There's nobody that I know that knows him that hasn't warned me that if he's back his up against the wall, he'll lie like crazy because he's lied all his life. The man is a liar, a proven liar. There's no way you're going to bring down the president of the United States on the testimony, uncorroborated, of a proven liar. And I guarantee you, this guy is a proven liar.
But I'm saying credibility is a problem for the president, too. That's not me being unfair. It's me being objective.
But you don't. The president's credibility is not an issue.
You don't think the president has a similar credibility problem?
He does not.
Yeah, no, he does. He does. He's a liar whose lawyer is lying about his lying lawyer's lies. This whole story is like a Dr. Seuss book called The Liax. So there you go. Giuliani said Cohen has been proven liar for years, and I'm sure Giuliani has always been consistent on that.
Are you concerned at all that Michael Cohen's going to cooperate with prosecutors?
No, I expect that he is going to cooperate with them. I don't think they'll be happy with it because he doesn't have any incriminating evidence about the president or himself. The man is an honest, honorable lawyer.
Oh, my God. You don't need to secretly tape these guys to catch them in a lie. Just point a camera at them and say, you're on TV now. So Trump entrusted Cohen with some of his most sensitive personal matters for a year, and now he's attacking him. And of course he is. Trump, his son, and their allies have denied dozens of times that Trump had any knowledge of the meeting when it happened, like last year when Trump defended his son to reporters and said he would never do anything wrong.
After spending the past few days hunkered down at the White House, reportedly fuming over the news that his top campaign aides, including his son and son-in-law, met with a Russian lawyer last summer to try and collaborate on defeating Hillary Clinton. The president told reporters, Don is, as many of you know Don, he's a good boy.
He's 40, and you're talking about him like he's a golden retriever.
He's a good boy, very loyal, and house-trained. You never hear the fake news talk about how he's house-trained, but it's been weeks since he's had an accident.
Although it would explain a lot if Trump thinks the older you get, the more you can act like a little boy, because Trump's a 72-year-old man who eats McDonald's, wants a Space Force, and gives people dumb nicknames. By the end of his presidency, his motorcade will just be Secret Service pulling him in a radio flyer. So their story's already shifted from saying the meeting wasn't about getting dirt, to saying nothing came of it, to saying even if something did come of it, that's politics. And today, Giuliani moved the goalposts even further, arguing that even if collusion did happen, it's not a crime.
I've been sitting here looking in the federal code trying to find collusion as a crime.
It's not.
Collusion is not a crime.
I'm not even know if that's a crime, colluding about Russians.
Okay.
You start analyzing the crime. The hacking is the crime.
That certainly is the original crime.
Well, the president didn't hack.
Of course not. That's the original
crime. He didn't pay them for hacking.
Nothing makes me happier than imagining Donald Trump personally doing the hack. Hunched over his keyboard with blue light on his face, just banging away with his tiny sausage fingers.
And we're in.
Yeah. I can't even imagine what Trump using a computer would look like. I'm guessing one of those videos of a dog playing a piano. So after it seemed like Giuliani was suddenly shifting from saying that Trump didn't collude to arguing that collusion isn't a crime, he called into Fox News later in the day to clarify his stance by insisting that both things can be true.
So when I said today that there was no collusion and therefore and that collusion also is no crime, I've been saying that from the very beginning, so did John Dowd. It's a very, very familiar lawyer's argument that in the alternative, my client didn't do it, and even if he did it, it's not a crime.
Oh, really? Because it looks like the police are already here. Seriously, this argument's insane. Just because Trump didn't do the hacking doesn't mean he's not complicit in the crime. And besides, Trump has already been very clear about who he thinks did the hacking.
On Tuesday, he told Time magazine that, quote, I don't believe they interfered. It could be Russian, it could be China, and it could be some guy in his home in New Jersey.
I mean, it could be Russia, but it could also be China. It could also be lots of other people. It also could be somebody sitting on their bed that weighs 400 pounds, okay?
There you go. It couldn't have been Trump. It was a guy in New Jersey who's fat.
We start this hour with President Trump, who is spending the weekend at his golf resort in Bedminster, New Jersey.
Wait, New Jersey?
At 6'3", 239 pounds, President Trump is just short of obese.
Oh, my God. This has been A Closer Look. Our guest is an award-winning novelist and short story writer. Her new novel, The Great Believers, was published earlier this summer to critical acclaim. Please welcome to the show, Rebecca Mackay, everyone. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Congrats on the novel. This is your third novel.
It is.
The first two were very well received. Does that make you feel very confident before your third novel comes out?
Oh, sure. Okay. No. No, you can't be because it's, you know, you're writing in total isolation. It's like getting dressed in the dark, like the complete dark. And then you have to go out on stage.
Yeah.
You know? And you don't know what you've done. You don't know what anybody's going to see until it's too late.
And not only dressed in the dark, but I would guess over the period of like 3 or 4 years.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's 4 years of
4 years
getting dressed
of like, these are the
dark.
Right pants. Yeah. Do you show it to people over the course of the 4 years? Like, do you have?
I do. I, you know, a few trusted readers. And for this one, because it is about the AIDS epidemic in Chicago, very sensitive subject, a lot of historical research. I really needed people to read it who could tell me where I'd gone wrong.
Oh, that's
there,
very helpful.
Who lived through it.
There are sort of two parallel stories. There is, as you mentioned, it's Chicago in the 80s and the AIDS crisis, and then modern day Paris. Characters from both sort of live in both the stories. Is that something with a plotting like that? Do you have to know that when you set out to write the story?
It might have helped, but I didn't.
Okay, gotcha.
So, I started off writing this story, you know, eventually, after a few missteps, about the crest of the AIDS epidemic in Chicago. It was all set in the 80s. And as I interviewed people, as I thought about it more, one of the things that was the most fascinating to me was the aftermath, the ripple effect 30 years later. How are people picking up, going on with their lives when they'd been handed a death sentence or when they'd lost everyone of their generation and they're the only survivor? So that was woven in later.
I was certainly more aware of San Francisco and New York as cities that were devastated by the AIDS crisis. And having spent a lot of time in Chicago, and you obviously are from Chicago, were you aware going into it as how affected Chicago was?
I knew a bit. You know, I was a kid when this was going on, and I was certainly tuned in to what was going on in the news. You know, you stay home from school and you watch Donahue or whatever, and you see some stuff. But of course, that was never about Chicago. Even though I was living in Chicago, I wasn't aware.
Right.
Became aware more as an adult, as I met people. I'm out there in the art world in Chicago, meeting people who were affected. Most of what's out there in book form and film form is about New York, San Francisco, maybe LA. And I feel like Chicago has been really underrepresented, which actually made it harder for me to do my research, but blessing in disguise because I couldn't just hide behind some books in the library. I had to get out and actually interview people.
This is very impressive because I sometimes think that our perception of authors is they just get to make up worlds and they don't actually have to lock into the details of it. But you used Google Calendar and Google Maps extensively to write this. How exactly were those tools that were effective
right.
for you?
So the Google thing. So I've tried all kinds of outlines for my novels. With this one, the calendar was really tricky because I'm moving back and forth between time periods, but also dealing with AIDS, the amount of time that would elapse between someone maybe getting the test and getting the result. You move one thing and your whole plot falls apart. So I was clicked back in my Google Calendar like 5 or 6 years until the days of the week matched up with the days of the week in 1985. And then I would enter all my events into the calendar.
I noticed that the days matched up. I check. I always check. That's like the first thing I do when I read a book. I'm like, I'm going to go in my Google Calendar if these don't match up.
You know what? Someone does.
Someone
and
does.
And we're going to get the emails. The writers are going to get the emails and we don't do that. But what the funny thing now is I'll use my Google Calendar and I'll try to be looking up something I have to do. So I'll type in like Wisconsin and it'll come up 15 things about my characters going to Wisconsin. I'm like, I was just trying to look up the Wisconsin Book Festival. I really. So I did that. And then the Google Maps, there were two things. I had this amazing intern one summer who made me an interactive online map of every gay bar in Chicago in 1986, which I hope was fun for him. I don't know. But so I could kind of walk around then with it printed out, walk around Chicago and see where everything was and kind of try to picture it. The other thing is, as I'm researching Paris, the other part of the book, you know, you can do that thing where you take the little blue dude and you drop him into the map and you can walk around and you can look left and right, which was awesome. But I was really hoping I'd have to justify a research trip to Paris, and this totally supplanted it. So.
You are the child of a Hungarian immigrant, yes?
Yeah.
And you would have, when you were growing up, you had immigrants stay with you? Is that?
Yeah, I had this kind of wild childhood. My parents were both linguistics professors, and then we were sort of a hub of Hungarian immigrant Chicago. Yeah, not really a normal childhood. It was kind of awesome. And my dad's a poet, so there was a lot of, he was writing his poetry in America, but in Hungarian, and then smuggling it back into Hungary.
How do you smuggle poetry?
Funny question. So what you do, if it's 1970s, is you get a box of disposable diapers.
Yep, that's what I would have done.
Because disposable diapers were brand new. You could get them in America. You can't get them in Hungary. So it's a pretty normal gift to be sending across the ocean to your relatives. And you cut them open. You take out the filling and you put a poetry manuscript in every diaper. Then you reseal the box. You send it. They open it, they take it out, and you have diaper poetry.
That is incredible, because every writer I know would basically at some point think a baby should on this. Yeah. And you're a professor in the MFA program at Northwestern.
Yeah.
Do you like teaching?
I love teaching.
That's
yeah.
great.
Yeah. It's, you know, it makes you so much better at what you do to have
sure.
to articulate it. And, you know, because other art forms, you can see someone work, right? If I were a painter, I could watch someone paint. If I were a musician, I could watch someone, you know, compose, make music. I can't go and stand over my friend's shoulders when they're writing novels. That
right,
would be
yeah.
super creepy. But I can work with students as they're writing novels, as they're writing short stories. And I'm learning from that in a way that is not otherwise available to me as a writer.
That is very cool. And thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Congrats on the book.
Thanks.
Rebecca Mackay, everybody. The Great Believers is on sale now wherever books are sold.
Hi, everyone. It's Sarah here from Late Night. I am here with Rebecca Mackay, author of The Great Believers. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
You spoke to Seth a little bit during your interview about having people read the early edition of this novel. You had really specific people in mind that weren't probably the same that read earlier versions of other novels. Can you explain who those people were?
I've had a lot of weight on my shoulders in terms of getting this story right. I'm writing across difference. I'm writing about a very sensitive subject. I'm writing about a time and a place where, you know, I was a kid in Chicago in the 80s, but I wasn't. My parents were not taking me to gay bars in 1985, sadly. I was 7 years old. So I really needed to get everything right. So I was interviewing doctors and nurses, for one thing, activists, lawyers, journalists, historians, and then just men and women who were there, who lived through this in Boys Town, which is exactly what it sounds like, in Chicago, people who've been HIV positive since the early 80s, who of course are hard to find,
right?
People who knew those people who watched over those people. And they enriched my book in so many ways. It really wasn't just factual research, it was emotional research.
You talk a good amount about the healthcare system in this novel. I was really surprised at the amount of detail in terms of how you go into, specifically for Yale, the way that men had to, mostly men had to kind of navigate the system and things that they should divulge or things that they shouldn't in order to get care based on like political maneuvering.
Yeah. The games you had to play with health insurance, because if they could, if the insurance companies could find the smallest toehold to try to say that you should have known you had a pre-existing condition, mm-hmm. they can completely deny you coverage. And you are now, I mean, you're dead. Even very quickly after the test came out, the test only comes out in 1985, but immediately, you know, if people, they've had health insurance all along, then they get the test and then they, you know, once, it's a couple of years until there's even anything that's useful for them. But right. once they, you know, 1987 AZT comes out and the insurance companies are going, no, look back, 1984, you had a thrush infection in your throat. So you should have known that that must be mean that you had this to begin with before you got the insurance. We're going to completely deny you coverage. But they're using basically anything. The lengths that they would go to deny people coverage were astonishing, even to someone like me who thinks very cynical thoughts about the healthcare industry and health insurance in particular. Right. I was gobsmacked.
And you've noticed not only parallels, but very similar things that are happening.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, there are parallels where insurance companies are always going to be screwing us over. People in power are always going to be taking power away, taking medical care away from the people who can least afford to lose it, who mm-hmm. have the least voice. But it's literally still happening. I mean, there are 37 million people living with HIV in the world right now. A million of them in America. Obviously, it's much less of a North American problem now. But, you know, the end of last year, Trump fires all the remaining members of the HIV/AIDS Advisory Council. Lord knows what was in that budget they passed, but one of the things we think was in it was that the proposal to cut $1 billion of U.S. aid in global AIDS spending, which is something that they've estimated will result in about 1 million deaths that absolutely could have been prevented. So this, you know, this is not just parallel. It's literally right. still happening. We are, you know, people are literally still finding ways to screw over people with AIDS because of, I don't know what they think about how they got it, what they think about who those people are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you think about if that were a certain type of cancer, if that were anything else, you know, that wouldn't have been singled out. Right. You know, no politician's going to go being like, you know what, right. let's stop all the leukemia funding. We don't need to, you know, like, that.
Yes.
There's a reason it's AIDS.
Another parallel that you drew in the novel that was kind of my favorite thing that you did was this discussion about World War I, the Lost Generation, and then the AIDS epidemic.
Right.
Can you just explain kind of a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we tend to think about the Lost Generation in Paris, right, which is what Gertrude Stein said to Hemingway about the group of American writers specifically that had arrived in Paris after World War I. Mm-hmm. But that generation was there before the war too, and specifically the visual artists were there before the war. And I was really interested in that generation of visual artists. We sometimes call them the École de Paris. So Modigliani, Soutine, Fujita, these people who came from all over the world, often from poverty, from kind of, you know, random villages somewhere, came to Paris to study because it was the age still of the Art Academy, mm-hmm. and started to make chosen families, started to really find a mecca in Paris. And then World War I comes through and the influenza comes through and decimates that generation. And so when Stein calls them the Lost Generation, she's talking about the people who are kind of the flotsam and jetsam washed up there again or for the first time after the war, trying to live in the aftermath. And I was really drawn in to the parallels between that and the AIDS generation in the U.S., people who got to cities like Chicago with, you know, coming from everywhere, coming because it was the one place they thought they could be happy, mm-hmm. making chosen family, that same sense of mecca, that same sense of finally belonging somewhere. And then this epidemic rolls through and decimates that generation. And, you know, similarly, I think I really consider this a war novel in so many ways. There are battles. And by the end of the novel, my characters are involved in activism and being out there in the streets fighting for their lives. So there's that part, but there's also, you know, how do you live afterwards? I always think of like the ending of A Farewell to Arms, which is so completely right. tragic. That sense of what do you do when the war is over and you're the survivor.
Right. How do you move on when you've lost almost everyone you know?
Right. Right. Which is what so many people are living through. And one of the most amazing things to me about publishing this novel is that I've been hearing from them.
Oh, that's why. Wow.
I've been my inbox every day. Like, I have to wait until I'm in the right moment to open my inbox, because I'm getting emails that are making me cry, that people who, you know, certainly talking to people like them. This is what I was trying to channel. But to hear from people, you know, there's the, you know, total ego thing of like, oh, I'm glad I had to hear I got it right. You know, but it's that's like, you know, 0.5% of it. It's mostly just like, I can't believe that I said something that spoke to people, and I can't believe that people are willing to write to me and share their stories with me. And, you know, it's that sense of almost feeling like you're getting a letter from your characters sometimes.
Yeah. And so going off on that, you're working with a Chicago-based food organization?
I am. So there is this incredible organization called Vital Bridges that grew out of an organization called Open Hand that I actually mention in the novel. They've been there on the front lines since the 80s, originally delivering food to people's homes and delivering meals. Now what they do is they run a grocery store, basically. It's basically a food bank, but it's set up like a grocery store, and it's awesome. It's got like cardboard cutouts of celebrities and feather boas and Christmas lights. It's the most amazing place. And the woman who runs it is this activist named Lori Cannon, who gave me so much of her time as I wrote the book. And I could not possibly write a book like this without, you know, giving back to the community that inspired it in some way. So what we're doing is, people who've purchased the book, whether it's on Kindle or the physical book, every time they post a photo on social media, especially Twitter or Instagram, Facebook, they have to tag my author page or something like that, with the hashtag #TheGreatBelieversDonate. I'm donating a dollar, but I also have 7 or 8 independent bookstores in Chicago that are matching me. So it actually adds up pretty fast. It's more than I could do on my own to give money to Vital Bridges. And it's the kind of organization that, you know, they're so small, they don't get big grants, they don't have big funds coming in. And in this environment, it's really hard. This is a hard time to be a small organization like that. It's a really hard time to fundraise. So, you know,
so this will make a difference.
Even a small amount will make a difference.
The best way to find information is through your website?
Yeah, my website is pretty easy. Okay. There's a big splash page on my website that you can click through to the donation project and find out. But it's just, you know, just post a photo of you in the book, your dog in the book.
Hashtag it,
your book sitting in a potted plant, whatever, and the Great Believers donate.
Yeah. Yeah. Great, perfect. Yeah. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. This has been fun.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle @LateNightSeth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of 2 young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When 2 of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but 2 trials that ended in hung juries, and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law & Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.